say. So, all right, thank you everybody for coming. This is like a nice, different environment than we're normally in. Thank you again to Gladys for hosting us today. Thank you to the JCC for hosting us today. And I'd like to speak, this topic could really, there's now, not only are there articles written on this topic, there are now entire books that are written on this topic. Could really give an entire series about this. But just to touch on the general theme of the dispute, or perhaps it's not even so much of a dispute, we'll get to that towards the end, of how to understand our avos and imos, our patriarchs and matriarchs. On one hand, perhaps they should be seen as the title says, paragons of perfection, or perhaps do we more view them as symbols of struggle, paragons of perfection, that everything they did was totally imbued with sanctity, they couldn't have done anything wrong, there must be anything that seems like they must have done wrong, that they did wrong, there really must have been some reason why they're not, and they're on levels of holiness that we can't even seem to grasp. On the other hand, one could say, no, they're people that struggle. They're people just like we're people. And as we'll see, the argument is put forth, if we're just simply going to view them as people that are beyond our comprehension and that we can't even relate to, so then how can we possibly learn from them? So we look at the actions of our avos and imos. Perhaps that's the entire reason why the parsha, why the Torah begins with the book of Bereishis as opposed to starting with the mitzvos that are given of Achodesh Hazelachem. Perhaps that reason is what's supposed to learn from them, and not just learn from them to see how great Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov were, but to see what can we take from their lives and put within our own. So there are, if somebody wants lengthier presentations of this, Rabbi J.J. Schachter has spoken about this a lot. He begins always with this piece from Avraham Cutler. I actually saw about a week or two ago, as I was preparing, I saw a colleague of mine in Boca Raton Synagogue, Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg, gave also a somewhat lengthier shiur on this topic. So there's what's out there if you want to look further. So Rav Aaron Cutler was quoted in a piece in the Jewish Observer. The Jewish Observer was the magazine of Agudas Yisrael. It no longer, I don't think it comes out at all anymore. I think it went, I don't think there's any Jewish, it stopped. It was one of the projects that Rav Moshe Scherer started. And in the Jewish Observer, it had a piece that Rav Aaron Cutler wrote. Oh, thank you. Rav Aaron Cutler wrote before he came to America. While he was still a Rosh Yeshiva in Slutsk, while he was still a Rosh Yeshiva in Lithuania, he already was known at a young age, he already was known as the leader or the future leader of the Lithuanian Jewish community. And there he took to the newspaper. He wrote an article. It appears in Yiddish. J.J. Schachter actually went back and found the article in Yiddish. I have it in my papers at home. But it was translated in the Jewish Observer. He says, I've recently been shown the last few issues of the newspaper Heint. How shocked I was to see the terrible blasphemies and the violations of the sanctity of our holy patriarchs and matriarchs that they contained. The laws of our holy Torah obligate me to react to this unheard of profanation of truth. Shame Shemayim in violation of the dignity of the Jewish nation, I feel compelled to depart from my usual practice and to issue the following public statement. The holy forefathers, who were most luminous, loftiest, purest personalities, the holiest creatures, represent the foundation of eternal spiritual vitality, the wellsprings of Chesed, the full range of positive attributes for the entire world and for all of mankind. The Avos are, in fact, held in the highest esteem by every nation on earth. The worst enemies of the Jews do not dare tamper with their luminous and holy image. And then he goes on to describe, continue in this way. I mean, anything you say that perhaps hints to the idea that Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and Sarah, and Rachel, and Rivka, that they weren't perfect in their actions, that is blasphemous. And in fact, he has in the svarim that have come out of his talks, there's a talk that he gave to a Torah Masorah convention where he spells this out. It's in his svarim in Hebrew, where he says that they're considered malachim. If they're not angels, they're angels minus the smallest amount, and that's how we should be viewing the Avos, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And that is not only Rav Aaron Cutler said that, but that one we'll see, and we'll see another source about this as well. That is the approach in the Lithuanian Torah world, that we just view them as as malachim, as angels, and perhaps Rav Aaron Cutler got that from his Rebbe, from the Alter of Slabatka, who we often quote in our first Seder Shirim. So the Alter of Slabatka, whenever he says anything about that might seem like it's hinting at a problem, a chisaron, a lacking in the forefathers or our patriarchs or matriarchs, it always is, obviously we can't understand exactly what he did wrong, but even the slightest amount is something that we should pick up on, and that's what we can learn from. So that is approach A. Approach A is Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, perfect, and we're not going to assign any blame. Approach B is we're putting out from Rav Shlomo Riskin, but we'll see that he certainly has backing. But just as a starting point, he has an article in his book, Listening to God, which are his memoirs, where he describes that he was once in England to give a class, and he goes to Manchester. There he's supposed to be the speaker at night, and he davened mincha that afternoon at a shtiebel of I forget the name of the chassidim. It's not in the paragraph that I put on the source sheet, but he goes and davens in some shtiebel that afternoon to daven mincha, and he looks on the wall that there's a terrible person coming to town, and make sure that you avoid, he's coming to give a public lecture, nobody that who's a Yiri Shemayim, nobody who fears the Lord, should possibly go to this lecture. So he's like, wow, who could that be? And he goes and looks carefully at the sign on the wall, and he realizes it's talking about him. He says, what did I do? I'm very surprised with that. So he showed the person who was pointing, he said, don't worry about it, you know, what they say doesn't really impact our community. But then he showed up to the lecture, and there were these chassidim that were actually standing outside with pickets saying that nobody could possibly go in and nobody should hear this person who's coming and speaking tonight. I mean, he davened in their shul, nobody knew who he was, right? He's just some guy coming to shul. All of a sudden now he's showing up. So what was the big problem? So he writes, a close reading of the indictment reveals that my heresy lay in an article on Moses that I had published in my weekly Jerusalem Post column. I suggested that while Moses succeeded more than any other human being in relaying the will of the divine to all generations, books of Moses, etc., you see the next underlined part, he failed as a politician. He failed in his duty to convince the Israelites to conquer and settle the land of Israel. I mean, there were lackings within Moshe, and that was his problem, therefore we should try to improve on that. And Rabbi Riskin has gone to this edge. He actually has, Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg in his talk, has a pamphlet that Rabbi Riskin published where he talks about why he does this and he brings sources for why he did it, and even apologizes at the end, maybe I should have, I was a little too rough in the way I wrote it, and maybe not everything one thinks should one say, not everything one says should one write, not everything one writes should one publish, but that is his approach, and it is grounded within sources. And there are certainly, if you go on various parsha sheets that come out of various places today, you'll see this theme as well, especially this time of year. As we go through the parshios of Bereishis, you'll see that Avram did, and one thing actually Rabbi Riskin wrote once, that Sarah actually was separated from Avram because Avram didn't take care of the family enough, that we don't see any other relationship in the Torah between Yitzchak and his children, and that's why they had, other than Yitzchak giving them the brachos, nowhere else do we see that they have a connection. This theme is out there of drawing criticism of the Avos in terms of their relationships with others, etc. So where does Chazal fall within this? So there is a famous Gemara in Maseches Shabbos where it goes through a couple of problematic stories within Tanakh, probably most prominently David HaMelech, where it seems that David had an affair. That's what it seems from the text of the Torah of the Navi itself. And it says, and it gives you the list here, Ruvain b'nei Eli b'nei Shmuel, David u'Shlomo v'Yoash. So those five people are the people that we're going to talk about them. And it goes through one by one saying to them, if you think they sinned, you're wrong. Kola Omer b'nei Eli chatu eino elatoa. All those that think that the sons of Eli sinned, they are mistaken. Now, what did the sons of Eli do? The sons of Eli were Eli was the Kohen Gadol in Shiloh. If you wanted to go bring a sacrifice, you had to go to Shiloh. And the pasuk describes that what happened is if a woman came to bring a sacrifice, the pasuk spells out that the sons of Eli slept with them. That's what the pasuk says. Now the Gemara says, well, how could that possibly be? So it says, no, that's not what it means. It means that when they came to bring a sacrifice, they didn't act on it fast enough, and that meant that the woman had to stay over an extra overnight, and they couldn't be with their husbands at night. That's the way the Gemara goes on to describe it. Meaning, it doesn't mean that actually, but yet the Navi says that the Navi does describe it that way. So, what's going on here? But nevertheless, the Torah says, or the Gemara says, no, it wasn't a sin like the Torah would have you believe, or the Navi would have you believe. It was something else that happened there. And the same thing happened with David. David, it sounds like David sinned with Abigail. In fact, David is punished for what he did with Abigail, and David is rebuked for what he did with Abigail. But yet, Kola Omer David Chote, Eino Ela Toa. Anybody who says David sinned, they're the ones that are mistaken. I'm sorry, with Bathsheba. I mean, I'm sorry, with Bathsheba. Not. I'm sorry, double with Bathsheba. Okay. Excuse me. All right. So that is perhaps certainly a source for the Rav Aaron Cutler school, that we can't possibly say that they sinned. Must be something else that took place. However, that very Gemara, before it gets into that, the top, that was on Shabbos 55b. On the top of 55b, the Gemara makes a comment that it says, Arba Mesu B'itiv Shal Nachash. It actually makes reference to the fact that Moshe sinned. We know that Moshe sinned. That's pretty explicit. But it says, four people die because of the bite of the snake. What's that referring to? Referring to the poison of the snake. That's referring to the snake at Gan Eden. I mean, there are four people who didn't deserve to die, but yet they're dying because, what can you do? They're human beings and they have to die. Implying what? That they didn't sin. These four people never sinned. So the Gemara says, these are the four people that never sinned. Who are they? Binyamin ben Yaakov, Amram Avi Moshe, so Binyamin the son of Yaakov, Amram the father of Moshe, Yishai the father of David, and Kilav the son of David. So those are the four people that never sinned, implying that what? Everyone else did sin. So, Rav Aaron Cutler, what do you mean we can't picture the Avos sinning? The Gemara says, four people sinned, and that's it. Right? There is, by the way, I heard a piece once from Rabbi Harlap, one of the dean of the yeshiva I went to. So I think he said it from his father or grandfather, that it's a little, these four people, they're presented in an interesting way. Binyamin, the son of Yaakov, that's what we call people, right? I'm Yonah Naftali ben Moshe. But Amram Avi Moshe, right? That's usually the way you call people. Why is Amram referred to as the father of Moshe? It should be Amram ben Levi, I guess, or Amram ben, someone ben Levi, right? Or ben Kahas, I guess. Or Yishai, the father of David. It should be Yishai. We know who Yishai's father was. Yishai's father is mentioned in the end of Megillas Rus. So why is he being referred to this way? He says, because they're all in relative to somebody else who is more famous than they are. Mm-hmm. And David, Moshe, Yaakov are all known for being great leaders, amongst our greatest people ever. So they sinned, the people connected to them didn't, but who's the one ultimately that's considered greater? So in order to really achieve greatness, sometimes that actually requires a bit of a sacrifice as well. That was the piece that he mentioned with this. Source number, the second idea that we quote here, is that the Gemara itself criticizes Yaakov in the place almost where you didn't have to criticize Yaakov. Yaakov, the Gemara comments that you shouldn't show favoritism from one son over another. Why not? And because Yaakov did show favoritism to one son over another, because he gave a little bit of wool to Yosef that he didn't give to the rest of the brothers, the Jews ended up going down to Egypt and they ended up being slaves there. Right, so the Gemara is an explicit refutation of the actions of Yaakov, even where the Torah doesn't explicitly say it's a problem. The Torah just says it happens. The Gemara comes and says, Yaakov was wrong. The Ramban, so that's the Gemara. Moving down in generations, the Ramban takes the story of Avram going down to Mitzrayim, where he had to tell and say that Sarah is my sister and not my wife. The Gemara, the Ramban says, Avram was wrong. He failed the test. He failed the test times two. He failed test number one is that he shouldn't have bothered leaving Israel. Either is no food. Avram should have had faith. And he failed the test in lying to Paro because he should have had more faith. He should have had a... Right? So Avram failed in his test of Emunah. That's what the Ramban says. The Ramban, a couple of times, criticized the Avos. And perhaps the most prominent person and the most expansive in explaining why he does it is Rav Hirsch. Rav Hirsch, on that pasuk about Avraham, makes the point of saying that the Torah doesn't hide the faults. That's what makes the Torah so great. The Torah doesn't hide faults, because if these people didn't have faults, we wouldn't be able to learn from them. The fact that they had challenges, the fact that they had struggles, makes the fact of how much they achieved even greater. And he gives the example of Moshe. We know that Moshe was the humblest person to ever live. Well, how do we know? Is that good? Maybe Moshe just had the genes to be the humblest person that ever lived. So Rav Hirsch makes the point, because we see Moshe at his angriest point, because we see Moshe yelling at the Jewish people and saying, Shimunah Hamor, listen to me, you rebellious people, that just shows how great he was in his humility. That highlights the fact that we know that he's humble, but yet we also know that he had a temper. Shows us that despite the fact that we might feel that we have personal traits that might be problematic, I still have the ability to grow, and I still have the ability to be great. That's Rav Hirsch's suggestion. Rav Hirsch is sliding into the Rabbi Riskin camp. Now, he talks about the great things that he did also, but he talks about this other places as well. I think I put on the sheet. Yeah, on the back, on page number 2, another piece that Rav Hirsch has. Rav Hirsch criticizes Yitzhak and Rivka and says that Yitzhak and Rivka weren't such great parents. If they were great parents, Esav would have turned out okay. That's what Rav Hirsch, you can read it yourself. I'm not going to read the entire thing, but part of the job of a parent is to figure out the nature of your child and figure out what should I do with the nature of that child to make sure that child succeeds. And Yitzhak and Rivka did great with Yaakov, and they didn't do so great with Esav. They should have figured out a way to channel the powers that Esav had. So that is for good, as opposed to for evil. So there clearly is sources in Chazal, and then moving down the line, that do take swipes, so to speak, at the Avos and say there are some things that they did that weren't so great, and we should learn from those things. The Torah doesn't hide, and purposely doesn't hide it. So this much of the literature about this comes up in the last couple of decades with the publishing of various histories of what is referred to here as being Gadol biographies. That's what this article happens to be about. But other types of history works where we sort of take things that happened in the past and paint them in the most beautiful light. We take the idea of yeshivas in Europe and things of that nature, and we sort of highlight, or there are publications that make those periods out to be wonderful, glorious, amazing, when perhaps they're covering up some of the trouble and struggle that took place during that era. So there is an article, and this dug up by Rabbi Goldberg in his talk. There's an article from the 2002 Jewish Action. Right, Jewish Action is the magazine of the Orthodox Union. A new issue just came out. It's available in our shul. And Rabbi Emanuel Feldman, who still he was a rav for many, many years in Atlanta, Georgia, built that community up. I thought he was. His book. Which book? He's got several books.
One he wrote about.
Oh, it's Tales Out of Shul. Okay. So I figured he was an elderly. I met him at an RCA convention a few years ago. He is still full of life. He is a gavra. He is still out there writing and speaking. A really wonderful person to meet. So he, Rabbi Emanuel Feldman. So on the top right. See, he has a talk in the beginning of it. I don't think it's an article. It's more of like his musings that he kind of put out. And he writes about the phenomenon of Gadol biographies, where he says, no sooner as a Rosh Hashiva or rabbinic luminary pass from the scene before we write his life stories. And and his complaint is that they all seem to be the same. That they all have the common themes. He was brilliant, profound, wise, righteous, kind. He never got angry, never discouraged, never wasted any time, never had any inner conflicts. And and look how amazing, what level they should be at. The article goes on for a while. He has a cute rendition of if we would apply this standard to the book of Bereishis. So on the right column, he says, one shudders to think how it would be written today. I mean, the book of Bereishis, the story of Yosef. The story of Yosef, he points out, is the longest narrative. The story of Yosef Yosef being sold by his brothers and then reunited is the longest narrative in the entire Torah. So one, how would it look today? So as for Jacob's favoring one son over another, we probably gloss over that. Yosef's lashon hara about them, we probably wouldn't mention that either. What about the story of Yehuda Tamar? There's no way that would be in a modern day biography of Yosef. The slaughter of inhabitants of Shechem, that would be unbecoming of the sons of Yaakov. The actual hurling of Yosef into a pit and his subsequent sale to slavery, would this not cast an unflattering and cruel light on the brothers and be expurgated from the story? I mean, all of those things maybe we would like to ignore. Today's biography would have a description of Yaakov and Yosef. For some reason they got separated. They always had emunah that they would get reunited, and ultimately they get reunited. But yet the fact that the Torah put that in means that we're supposed to be learning from those troubling things which the brothers did over the second half of the book of Bereishis. That's the theme of his article. On the left side of the page, you have a letter that was written into Jewish Action by Rabbi Nissan Wolpin. Who's Rabbi Nissan Wolpin? So he was actually the editor at that time of the Jewish Observer. So you have the editor of the Agudas Yisrael magazine writing into the article of the OU magazine, complaining and echoing the theme that Rabbi Aaron Cutler wrote about in the 10 years earlier in the article that I started with. He's a quote from Yaakov Kamenetsky, from Aaron Cutler, from Gedalia Shur, that they all focused on that these people were all great, and you even have Esav. The greatness of Esav was beyond our reckoning, and all these people were great and beyond anything that we can comprehend. And he writes at the end, we dare not risk belittling the like of Yosef and his brothers by equating them with us in any fashion. Right, we just can't compare. Rabbi Emanuel Feldman actually has a response to him, it's only a lunch and learn, so we're not going to get into his response, but still, he gets responded to, and it's a machlokus. There's a famous line from Rav Schwab here at the bottom, where Rav Schwab takes on the idea. Rav Schwab was in the Agudas Yisrael world. He was the Rav in the German, in the Breuer's Kehillah in Washington Heights in the 60s, 70s, 80s. He has a piece where he says, what about history? What about the facts of history? Rav Schwab says, there's no mitzvah to study history. There is a mitzvah to get inspiration from our past. And the fact that some of these things may not be historically accurate, that doesn't necessarily bother us. So I think we have there's really two approaches. How do we just take everything as facts, and even though it might not be so pretty, or do we, kind of push everything and say that no, it's, we have to gain from the inspiration, we can't necessarily, we're not going to really compare ourselves to them. We just, we recognize that our leaders are malachim, and therefore we're people that are trying to clamor onto the malach. You can obviously see the extensions that this machlokus would have to other areas of hashkafa, etc. But, okay, so how do we approach this? So one approach is to just say, I think there's really three approaches. One approach is to just say, it's a machlokus, it's a dispute. That one approach is to say, as we said, that they're angels, and the other that is really just to divide it up. Paragons of perfection. Some say we have to just always try to put them as much as possible in the paragons of perfection camp. And one camp says, no, they're always going to be in the struggle camp, and we're just going to have that. It's a dispute. I think approach number two is to say, well, shivim panim l'Torah. Not only is it a machlokas, and one side is right and one side is wrong, which some would have you believe. It's just, there's different approaches into the way that how one approaches learning mefarshim. And, we have this in many areas. There's the Mikra, Drash, Sod, etc. And this is also two approaches. When we take stories, do we analyze them totally lekav schus, or do we take perhaps a more struggle-centered approach? And then, so that's kind of how I always thought about this. I never really thought of a way of bridging this gap. But as I thought about, preparing for this morning, I think one can bridge it a little bit. Not all the way, but I think bridge it a little bit closer by saying, well, it depends what your starting point is. I mean, is your starting point going to be the Avos are clearly greater than we were? Or the Avos were obviously major Talmidei Chachamim, brilliant, all those kinds of things, and extended to our Gedolim as well. Right? We start at that point, and we do judge them what we call the Kav Schus. We judge them favorably. But there are some things that perhaps don't fit into that, and we're instructed by Chazal to perhaps not judge them as favorably. And why is that there? It's there to follow, to use a terminology from the laws of Lashon Hara, it's there l'toeles. It's there for a purpose. It's there to help us out. It's there to give us a little bit more, to give us a more of a handle on how we can actually learn from them. So I think that, and then there's a machlokas, not of which one is right and which one is wrong, but rather the machlokas, the dispute really is, at what point do we start sharing a little bit more of the not as perfect perspective. I mean, at what point do we? I think we the starting point is the way we teach. When I teach an elementary school child, the idea that Yaakov was wrong in the way, or Yitzhak was wrong in his treatment of Yitzhak, of Yaakov and Esau, not necessarily. They're perhaps not ready for it yet. But would I teach an adult that? Would I teach somebody in a parenting class that, who can perhaps understand that? Well, if it's going to say, well, obviously we see that Yitzhak was a bad parent, and obviously it means that we can't really learn anything else from Yitzhak either, because he obviously made many mistakes in his life, well, then you got a problem. But if the starting point is that, no, there's much that we can learn from Yitzchak, there's much that we can learn from his emunah, there's much that we can learn from his actions by Akedas Yitzchak, there's much that we can learn from his tefillos, from the way that he davens. It's just, all right, there was this one issue, and maybe that's something, we see that that was wrong, and we have to improve from that. So I think that that perhaps is an approach that we could take, and I think that's an approach that I've taken generally in my teaching. The starting point is if somebody is, you know, rub this and recognize as a gadol b'Torah, they probably are, and they are. And then there are perhaps some interesting things along the line, way, that perhaps we can learn from. So, okay. So then we'd go ahead and learn from that as well. And that's not necessarily to lower, to take away from the things that they've done in their life. Perhaps that even highlights the things that they've done in their life. There is a famous letter that Rabbi Feldman makes reference to in his writings here, and others, many make it of Rav Putner, where a Talmud in Yeshiva wrote to him saying, I'm never going to be good enough, I'm never going to be smart enough, all of the rabbis, I'm told, are these amazing, creative, unbelievable characters, and I'm not one of those. To which Rav Putner responded, right, that's the problem of reading this and assuming they're all like that. They're not all like that, they had to struggle. Do we think that the Chafetz Chaim was great because he never struggled with Lashon Hara, or do we think the Chafetz Chaim was great because he identified the struggle and figured out a way to overcome it? So, as I said, there is much, much more to really discuss on this topic, and cover whether it's appropriate even to cover things up. Is appropriate even to not reveal things that really should be that. There is much to talk about, but I think this is kind of forms a basis for that discussion. Rabbi Cutler, Rabbi Riskin's approach, not necessarily comparing the two, but just kind of taking the two approaches, or Hirsch's approach, the Ramban's approach, the Gemara's approach, and really the distinctive Gemara's. There's some Gemara's that seem to indicate both ways, and then how do we put them together? So, thank you very much for coming. Hope you either will enjoy or have enjoyed your lunch, and hopefully we'll do this again in a couple of weeks. Yes?